Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is AppSats Radio, help for partners after sexual betrayal. We talk about it here.
Betrayal trauma.
We are AppSats certified clinical partner specialists and coaches who have been trained to help navigate you through this crisis. There is nothing we won't talk about.
Sometimes listeners want to know about triggers.
I'm dealing with the aftermath of my husband's affairs, and he still works the same job that he did when he was acting out. It's a job that allows him to hide his goings-on and one that he stated was a previous trigger for his acting out. The whole 16 and a half years we've been together, he's acted out. In the beginning, what I thought it was just pornography. It ended up being, I found out 2.5 years ago, he had been with multiple prostitutes. I only found out a very small portion of that until about a month ago. How do you cope with all of that when you still have to deal with unavoidable triggers?
Well, of course you would feel traumatized by hearing all that information. And I gotta tell you, Stephanie, that's a staggered disclosure. That's finding out little bits and pieces about your husband's behavior throughout a time period, making you feel insecure, unsure, and unsafe. So what we gotta do is set up a situation whereby you get with a specialist to do a formal disclosure so you can hear everything at one time in a safe environment.
Yep, that is what you strive for now. We want you to hear things in a safe environment. Because what we know is partner betrayal is excruciating. And if you decide that you want to learn the truth, we definitely know that it's important for you to be able to be with an advocate who absolutely understands where you are coming from. Okay. Hey there, I'm Carol Jurgensen Sheets, aka Carol the Coach. And I am so happy to be with you. You know that this is really a passion of mine to disseminate information in all sorts of ways that will help to make a difference in your life. It'll add some clarity. You won't feel so alone, and you'll get yourself to the right resources. I'm always asking for emails, and if anybody ever wanted to call the show, let me know ahead of time, and I will get you the number, and we can talk on air about your special situation. Now, I got an email from Sandra, and she says, "Hello. I love your podcast, and it has been an instrumental tool in helping me heal my betrayal trauma that was caused by my husband, who recently relapsed after 6 years. You encourage questions on your podcast, so I have one for you. My husband and I recently went through a disclosure in which he revealed about 25 different sexual partners in the course of the past 6 months. These encounters were comprised mostly of sex workers as well as 20-something-year-old women that he had met on dating sites and had one-night stands with. Several of the women he met and had multiple sexual sessions, including hotels, dinners, and conversations with, and some of these women he lied to and said he was not married, and others knew he was married. I am deeply hurt and betrayed and understand this was my husband's decision and addiction at work. As part of my healing process and in attempts to be transparent, I would like him to come clean to the women he had unprotected sex with and encourage them to go and get tested. I think it's important for these women, the willing participants, to also have the opportunity for disclosures and have the information to make informed choices when they choose to have sex with people they meet online. I also feel it's best to give them transparency and have my husband see them as people, not sex objects. My husband, of course, feels that this would give the women unnecessary hurt. He doesn't want to hurt them. What's your take on this, Carol? And thanks so much. Now, what I know to be true is that this is really an unusual request that the partner is asking for, and I 100% endorse whatever you need to heal. It seems like to me, Sandra, that you are expressing how deeply hurt and betrayed you feel, and that you also know that it would help your healing process for him to come clean with the women he lied to. And you absolutely can make that request. I say it's unusual because I've never had a partner request that of sex workers. I have had partners who obviously have said, I want you to call your affair partner and I want you to tell her blah, blah, blah. But I've never had this occur, and I'm 100% behind you. You know, there's all sorts of ways to look at this situation. People that you meet on site, on websites, sex workers. In reality, they certainly are taking a risk, a physical risk, a psychological risk, an emotional risk. But if he lied to them, it's important that he makes it right, because honesty is at the core of addiction. And so this would be something he could easily stay in denial about, because I bet he knows of nobody who's been asked to call people on the website and say, hey, I had unprotected sex. I encourage you to go get checked. And by the way, there's this thing called the disclosure, and you may need that for me. And I don't know. What I do know is that you're in the driver's seat. But you're only in the driver's seat, and by that I mean you can make these requests. But if you make the request and he absolutely refuses, and you said, my husband feels this would give the women unnecessary hurt. Yeah, it would give them hurt. I wouldn't put the word in unnecessary. It encourages him to be honest and to fess up. Helps them to understand the risk that they're taking by not knowing somebody and doing some of your own investigation on someone. And I don't mean investigation as if you're an officer, but I do think that in this day and age, it's important for women who meet men online, and there's nothing wrong with that, to take some time to really get to know the person. So, if he says no, here we go. If he says no, what you going to do next? Is there going to be a consequence for the no? Are you just going to let it drop? Are you going to be angry? Well, I know you're going to be angry, but what are you going to do with the anger? How long might you be angry? Are you going to want to create some sort of consequence that says, I can't trust you, and you're not trustworthy. Therefore, I want you to sleep in a separate bedroom, or I want you to go stay at a hotel for the next couple of weeks, or I want you to make an amends letter and at least write out your apologies and your truth, even if you won't give that to the person that you deceived. So that's my answer, that yes, you have every right to request this, although unusual. Yes, you need to be prepared for his potential answers. And then you need to decide whether you need a consequence. So many of my clients, they mean well, that they'll create a boundary, and then when the boundary is broken, there's not a consequence other than a broken heart. And by the way, speaking of hearts, I want to say to you, Sandra, that this has to have been really hard for you, because you allege, and he alleges, that he's been in good recovery for about the first 6 years, and then he had a major relapse. And it sounds like you might need a second disclosure to make sure that he's being honest with you, that he's telling you the entire truth, that he hasn't forgotten things. Now, again, what I know about disclosures is you may have enough information and you don't want to put another single thing in that head of yours. And boy, I get that. But you certainly went through a significant betrayal when he had sex with these women, met with them in hotels, had dinners and conversations. I mean, you and I both know, as well as the listening audience, that this was rough information to hear. And now your world has been shattered again. All right. I want you to know there are plenty of places that you can go for help. I hope you've got an APSATS-trained therapist or coach. I hope you're in some sort of recovery group if you think that would be helpful, or online group. And I want you to know you're not alone. And keep listening to the podcast. And thanks for a great question. I actually got this email this morning and told her that we would be talking about it on the show. So I know she's listening. And I know that she may have additional questions for me based on my answers. Now, today we've got a fascinating guest. I love, love, love when a guest is a graduate of a program that he now works for. And that's what we got. We've got Tim Kernan, who's a proud graduate of Prescott House. And this house, this treatment center has special meaning for me, not so much for sex addiction, although I got to tell you, they have 6 CSAT therapists on staff. But it has special meaning for me because I sent a young heroin addict to Prescott House. His mother and I did. And he lived at this house for over a year, got a job. I said to the mom, I'm really afraid your son's going to die. He had a horrible heroin addiction. There was no desire in him to change. And he went to the Prescott House, and he got sober, and he stayed longer than he thought he would. I think he stayed a year and a half. And then he lived off-site. I do believe it was in another halfway house that they set him up with. And he has had 3.5 years of good, solid recovery. So I think the world of this treatment center. Now, Tim was trained by Patrick Carnes, and so he absolutely understands sex addiction. And he has a special place in his heart for family members and partners. So he's going to be talking about the questions and dilemmas that he's encountered while working with betrayed spouses and partners and loved ones. And he's going to be talking a little bit about why long-term care may be the only answer. And let's face it, that is a real commitment on the family's part and on the addict's part. So I'm just really excited to have Tim Kernan on the show. Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio. How are you, Tim?
I'm great. Thanks, Carol. How are you?
just fine. Did you hear my little talk about mutual patients?
I did, and I really thank you for the endorsement of our program. I'm incredibly proud to be a part of it.
Well, I bet, and it changed your life, too. I'm incredibly happy to know that you're willing to share a little bit of what your life was like and how you full circled back into that treatment center and the fine work that you're doing. So tell us a little bit, what made you decide to leave a really successful career in nonprofit administration and to begin your work with addicts and their families?
Well, it started actually prior to me entering into that profession. I'd always felt, called and drawn to, helping people, being in the helping profession. In fact, at one point, I studied to be a priest for the Diocese of Nashville, Tennessee, and, I left that. I kind of discerned that wasn't the route for me to take, and I thought that, going into the nonprofit world would be a way to do that. The longer I was there, the less joy I found in doing it, and I knew that I needed to do something a lot more personal and on a one-on-one basis. So that I had a great therapist, and he really encouraged me to go to grad school and get my master's in marriage and family therapy. And I was in recovery since 2006. Or I shouldn't say was. I am in recovery since 2006, and it was just a natural fit for me. My first job out of graduate school was at a sex addiction treatment program at a treatment center called The Ranch, and it was great to be trained under the tutelage of Rob Weiss, and became a CSAT while I was there as well. I was trained by Pat Carnes, and one of my main roles there was not only to work with the addicts, but also to work with the betrayed spouses and partners and families of the men that I worked with. And, once I'd been doing that for a few years, I determined that, I found my calling. And it's just been rewarding work and really enriching. And it's just joyful to watch these men make these transformations and realize the impact that they've had on their families negatively and positively. Help them get out of shame, realize they're good people that just have done not good things, and help them turn their lives around, and also help, their loved ones start the process of recovery on their own and start the process of healing in their lives. And watching from a distance, albeit, but still watching the transformations that I saw with the spouses and partners. And, occasionally somebody will reach out to me via email, or they'll find me on, Facebook or Instagram, and I'll get a message about the work I'd done and the impact that it had in their lives. So I guess that's why.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. And, boy, when you think about partners and family work, even though we were trained at ITAP to do disclosures and to include the family when it was asked for or appropriate, we've come a long way since your days with Rob Weiss and The Ranch, because we're really promoting a whole new way to work with partners. And so wouldn't you agree that we're all pioneers in this field, but truly we are creating programming that is very specific to each person's need in the family?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In the work that APSATS has done to really create kind of I speak in metaphor, so just, pardon the metaphor, but just kind of create a safe space for the spouses, for the partners, kind of create a bubble of their own so they can be taken care of in the moment and long term. And that's what I discovered, having facilitated, dozens of disclosures, that it's kind of like serving up this platter of mess on a silver platter to a spouse or a partner the addict feels great, you know, oh great, I got this off my chest. But the spouse, the partner is just left with this platter full of mess. You know, it's kind of like, what am I supposed to do with this now? And that was one of the big dilemmas I had as a CSAT and you know, facilitating disclosures. You know, in the beginning, there was no real relief other than to say, go get a therapist and, you know, do your own work. And I'm so happy that, you know, ABSATs and they're meeting the need of the partner for safety, for healing, so that they can safely do their own work.
Well, and I know for partners and addicts, this is the toughest addiction to work on and work with. And, you know, slips and relapses occur frequently, and sometimes the sex addict just can't get a handle on the tools necessary to make their life different. And so, you know, you are a proponent of long-term treatment. So tell us a little bit about what you would consider long-term treatment and why you see that as so advantageous for sex addicts.
Absolutely. You know, kind of getting back to the beginning of that question, you know, it's easy to tell, comparatively easy to tell, if someone's drunk or high or, you know, engaging in gambling or, you know, their food addiction as compared to sex addiction, problematic sexual behaviors. It's easier to hide, and that's where the addiction lives, is in secretive, you know, in secrecy rather, and it lives in just kind of playing a shell game. You don't need to spend money to be full-blown in your addiction. So you can't track it on a, you know, the your bank statements, for example. And, you know, the reason why I think that long-term treatment works, particularly with sex addicts, and with, you know, an addict of any stripe, is you can't be in a community for too long without being found out. One of the strengths of the Prescott House is that when men arrive, they're in a primary group for, you know, our average length of stay is 4 to 7 months. So, you know, they're in a primary group. They're seeing the same men every day. The community physically is small, intentionally so. You just can't get away with, you know, the old behaviors. And one of the beautiful things about Prescott House is, you know, you're in community for a long period of time. You go to group every morning, but also in the afternoon, you're expected to go out into the community and volunteer. You're expected eventually to get a part-time job. And in doing that, you learn how to live life. But then when that, you know, addict, when that kind of dark passenger voice starts talking to you, you know, hopefully and usually it's found out, if not admitted by the client, eventually, you know, a peer of the client will say, man, you're not acting normal. What is going on with you? Or, you know, you seem to slip away for a little bit while you're volunteering. What's happening there? And eventually, you know, it becomes a pattern of men coming to group, facing their truth and being confronted in a loving way, but also hopefully the men will start, you know, telling on themselves and then start saying, you know, when I saw, you know, somebody on the street that appeals to me or is attractive to me, I engaged in fantasy, and this is problematic behavior, and I need help around this. And one of our favorite sayings is, you know, help that man or help this man. You know, when somebody will say something in a community setting, somebody else will say, you know, help this man. We need to help. And ultimately, we want our clients to be able to do is to say the four hardest words for any man to say is, I need your help. And that's why one of the reasons, or, you know, a multitude of reasons why it's so advantageous for our men to be there so long, because they need to learn how to live life. I worked in a primary treatment center for several years, and it's a great building block. I used to tell, you know, family and loved ones, we're building a foundation for a house to be built on. You know, 28, 35, 45 days is a great way for our clients to build a foundation. But when they get home, they need to build the house. What we do with at Prescott House is we offer them the supplies, you know, the metaphorical supplies, and to rebuild their lives, to reintegrate or even integrate into, you know, normal life. Volunteering, showing up, being responsible, managing your own money. If you know, taking meds if that's appropriate. Our men aren't, you know, they're held accountable if they don't take their meds on time, for example. And there's this, you know, I could spend 2 hours telling you all the different things that our clients are going to encounter specifically, but you know, we want. And the goal of this is not necessarily for our men to graduate, but it's for our men to live good lives.
Yeah, I get that. And, you know, you said before, toughest words for a man to say, or maybe you said an addict, because I was thinking both, is I need more help. I mean, men in general have not been taught that to go in for what I call the big ask. And when you've got an addict who's male, he's got a double whammy for not wanting to admit that he needs more help. But truly, Tim, I'm a life coach and a mental health therapist, and my second favorite coaching principle for anybody out there is to go in for the big ask. And that's why for partners it's so important while their husbands are struggling to make sure that they're getting enough support. And what do you think, how do you think this impacts families? Because we're talking maybe a year of long-term treatment, right?
Could be, yeah. You know, the way our program is structured is, you know, the first phase, if you will, is being in community full-time. You spend, you know, every morning you're in group. But also every morning you've got to go attend a 12-step fellowship meeting out in the community, whether that be for sex addicts or our guys that are there for chemical addiction. You know, the day begins with a meeting, and then you go to group. And then, you know, the big ask really, you know, comes over time for a lot of guys. You know, as men, we're conditioned to be strong, to be the brave ones, and vulnerability is not a part of our you know, vocabulary. Vulnerability is looked at as weakness. And I think, too, for a lot of partners, just being willing to ask for help, particularly in light of the fact that we hear, and I've heard time and time again, how could I be so stupid to think that my husband, my partner, wouldn't do this? Am I not attractive enough? Am I, you know, all those questions, those self-doubts. And when people get caught in that trap, it becomes so difficult just to reach out for help because it might make them look bad. I mean, there's a whole host of reasons, but it could make them look bad in their eyes. It might make them look stupid or unattractive or you name it. It is just so important for the partners to be able to, you know, begin to articulate that.
Well, I 100% agree with that. And clearly, you're right. This is so damaging to the core beliefs of partners, and they're wondering why they're not good enough and what they could have done differently. And then they feel broken. And, you know, there's that old adage for addicts that an addict in good recovery feels broken, is open, and is humble. And for a partner, she needs to build herself up. She needs to find the right support. She needs a lot of intentional self-care. So do you have people at Prescott House that talk to her?
Yeah, we do. One of the things that we're you know, strident about is including the families in the partner's recovery. Now, of course, it's true for any treatment center or any medical professional that we have to have permission from the addict in order to do this work. And, you know, surprisingly, it happens often and most of the time where the addicts give consent to say, okay, let's bring in, you know, the wife, the partner, mom or dad into this process. The way our process works in particular is, you know, our primary therapists are in touch with their families, you know, on a weekly basis or more. We are open and encourage particularly spouses and partners to reach out to us, and we also do the same. We reach out to them. Eventually, we have a family program, and actually we have a family program specialist who will coordinate bringing the families to Prescott, and we have it's a lot less intense than your traditional family program that a lot of people may have encountered at other treatment centers. But because we're a reintegration program, the way our thing it looks like is on a Friday, usually the whole day will be spent with the therapist and the family. And then that weekend, our clients plus one of the client's buddies that our clinical team assigns will spend the weekend together. And this is where the reintegration happens. It's, you know, looking at maybe identifying who's the person that kind of throws a proverbial hand grenade in the middle of the room to set things off. You know, can a partner and a spouse be together? If not, then what are strategies? What can we glean from all this? And so taking all that information that we get from the Friday and the weekend, the buddy also gives input, you know, what did he see happen? We take all that information and we start to develop an aftercare plan. So they're there with us long enough where we can get a full 365-degree view of the client, but then we can also get a 365 of the family, and then we try to find the most appropriate aftercare option, and that could be go home, you know, engage in family work, do intensives. More often than that, we encourage our clients to, consider staying in Prescott for our aftercare program. And what that looks like is, they'll begin going to group every day in the morning, have a part-time job, and finding a place to live. That could be, several living facility that there's several in town. A lot of our people, myself included, will get apartments. You know, that's what I did. I lived in an apartment and with a guy that was also in the program with me. But, you know, the whole time we're monitored by, the Prescott House monitors the clients. And so there's a variety of ways that we, use to meet the needs of the client. And we're very specific about the particular person. So we don't, it's not a one-size-cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all program. What we want to do is take the whole family system into account and then make the recommendations based off our observations and the work that we're able to do with the families.
Yeah, and I get that it's not a one-size-fits-all, and you customize the care based on what they need. Now, do you think that the betrayed partner can ever begin to forgive the addict?
Yeah, I do. My hope is they don't forget. When I have worked with other partners, you know, the process of forgiveness may begin very well soon after a disclosure. May not, and probably more times than not it doesn't happen, but, I guess to answer your question, can forgiveness happen? Yes, and I've seen it a lot. Does the hurt stop? I don't know. Personally, I don't know. But I think it depends.
Personally, you don't why?
Can sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
You said personally, you don't. You what?
Oh, I don't have personal experience in being betrayed.
Got it.
Yeah. I can tell you what I've seen, and what I've seen is yes, forgiveness can happen. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And that's my feeling too. It's a process, and it takes a long time. And I know we at APSET say, if you choose not to forgive, if you can't forgive, you need to be kind and gentle to yourself and just accept what is. However,
yeah.
For a lot of women, they want to forgive because they feel that's a healing component to their own recovery. And so when they're looking at forgiveness in that way, we can always get them to forgive themselves, if nothing else, even if and when they can't forgive the addict. Now, trust, on the other hand, is a lot tougher. And, you know, what's your experience? Do you believe that the partner can trust again? And what goes into building that trust process?
Yes, I do. You know, and when I've worked in primary therapy, or primary treatment rather, with my clients, I've, you know, one of the things I would tell partners was, don't trust what your partner is saying. Don't trust what the addict says. Because it's so easy to fall back into those old patterns. You know, the homeostasis of any relationship wants to take back over because, you know, we all want to forget the pain and we want to move past it. And I think a lot of us have been conditioned to do that. Trust can be rebuilt. Rob Weiss and Marnie Faree from Bethesda Workshops, they just came out with a book called Out of the Doghouse. And when I worked for Rob, we talked about, you know, you're in the doghouse. And for the addict, they've lied, manipulated, played a shell game for so long with their partners that they don't want to hear, I'm sorry. They don't want to, you know, hear how the addict is so, you know, horrified at their behaviors and can't believe what they've done to hurt them. What the partners want to see is action. My advice to every partner I've worked with is do not trust the addict at first. Don't fool yourself into thinking that this can be, you know, cured overnight. It is like building a house on a foundation. It takes time. I think Rob, when I was working with him, he always says, you know, you're looking at about 18 months before the trust starts to reemerge. Until then, you know, you're on notice. And as an addict, you know, you've got to follow through with what you say, even the little stuff. If you say, I'm going to be home at 5 o'clock, be home at 5 o'clock. If it means that you're going to be late going to the grocery store, you know, it doesn't matter. Be home at 5 o'clock. Just the little things. Those are the things that rebuild trust. And I think a partner should hold the addict to that standard, not so the partner or so the addict can recover faster, but so the addict can – but so the partner can start to trust her or himself, to get rid of that gaslighting, the crazy making, the thought of maybe I'm the one, maybe I've got it wrong, set the boundary and hold the boundary and have consequences if the boundary is not held.
Yeah, good point. Absolutely valuable to look at the integrity of the addict in just his word. Have you ever read the Four Agreements?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And
be
you
impeccable
know,
with your word.
Agreement. Yes, exactly. And that doesn't just mean don't lie, but it also means not to gossip, not to be critical, not to be aggressive. I mean, it really says, hey, You need to be able to be trusted and trustworthy. And as a result of that, that process does take a while. I mean, I've had addicts in my groups that they will be asked by their wife 3 times from downstairs, have you taken out the trash yet? No, no. And then the 3rd time, they just say yes, because they're going to do it in 5 minutes. And then they jump up and they're like, geez, Louise, I did it again. I lied to her. And, you know, they grab for the trash and run it outside and hope they don't get caught. And then I tell them, you know what? I get that you did that. That was the easiest thing to do. You knew you were going to do it. But the bottom line is you need to let her know that you hadn't been honest, that you told her yes just to make it convenient, and that you did do it and you caught yourself, and you'll continue to work hard on that. Because, boy, that's what partners need. They don't need their husbands to be perfect. They need their husband's truth.
Absolutely. You know, I hear all the time how the partner feels like she, you know, if she has 3 kids, she actually feels like she has 4, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The addict, when he's in his active addiction, is in this, you know, ego state of being an adolescent. It's like they're raising another kid. So, yeah, just taking your example, you know, that's something I would do. You know, run the trash out even though I've been caught having not done it, so just so I don't get in trouble. And that just puts the spouse or the partner right back in that position of, you know, authority, of having to parent the adult. And it really just creates an unfair dynamic for the partner.
Well, it really, really does. And again, truthfulness and honesty is at the core of healthy recovery. And so it is a tough thing when an addict has spent the majority of their life lying to really work on that value, but it is such an important value.
Absolutely.
So now, I just want to ask you, how can people get a hold of the Prescott House and find out more about it?
Well, the easiest way is to go on our website, and it's prescotthouse.com, P-R-E-S-C-O-T-T, house, H-O-U-S-E.com. Our 800 number is on there, which I will say, I know you said you were going to put that on your website, but the 800 number is 866-425-4673. Well, I wanted to get back to the point you just made earlier about,
sure.
You know, we were just talking about, you know, putting the spouse, you know, in that position of authority, but those little lies. That's right there. That's a perfect example of what we do at the Prescott House and how we help the man. You know, we give them the opportunity to say, hey, I really screwed up, you know, or I didn't take out the trash and I got to own that. There's going to be some accountability there from your peers, whether they say, I'm really disappointed with you, that makes me angry. There may be, accountability from the staff. But, you know, what we're trying to do, what our aim is, one of our aims is so the men can, you know, be equipped to go to his wife or his partner and say, hey, you know what, I did screw up there, I'm sorry. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about life skills. You know, the trash example is a perfect example of the work we do. So thanks for indulging me on that.
Well, absolutely. And again, for our listening audience, we're talking about long-term care here. And I know that I consider it for a client that just can't seem to get much traction, or they have been in 30 and 45-day residential treatment centers, and their environment hadn't changed enough to support them. And so, I mean, there are very few treatment centers that work with an addict the way you do and the longevity, the length of time that you spend with them. I mean, this is really like They're in a dorm situation, learning about their sexual addiction, which Patrick Carnes says is the second recovery task of any addict, the first being to get out of denial, the second one being to understand their addiction. And then you take them through the process of how to live with integrity. And that has got to be very fulfilling, especially because you're using the guys to help them to do that. And I got to tell you, Tim, when I was in line with Patrick Carnes, we were getting our food at Cumberland Heights, and I was being trained. I said, Patrick, if there's one bit of advice you could give me in working with sex addicts, what would it be? And he said, Carol, I would start a therapy group for men, because addicts need to be able to talk out their life. And they need other addicts to hold them accountable. And a sex addiction therapy group will do just that. And then I think, well, then the Prescott House, my goodness, that's like a therapy group on steroids. I mean, it's 24/7.
It is. You know, we tend to put our groups, you know, the sex addiction guys will be in a primary group usually, whether they're sex addicts, and then we'll also have men that, you know, present to us with, you know, substance use disorder, but also have problematic sexual behavior. So those men will also, you know, join our groups, just, you know, even if they're not, you know, the classic sex addict, but do have sex problems, they'll be put in groups with our sex addiction guys. But, you know, to your point, yeah, two groups a day. Their primary group, there's a break, and then they go into what we call a process group. And in the process group, they're mixed up with all the clients from the entire program in separate groups. And so everybody gets to know each other to talk out their story, like, you know, Dr. Karn said. But also, you know, it helps with shame reduction. It helps with, you know, identification. You know, we occasionally will have guys that come in and you know, think that their cocaine use or their, you know, excessive drinking is a problem. The real problem is they're engaging in, you know, sex addiction behaviors. And so that kind of that cross-pollination allows for a lot of awareness, not with just the sex addiction, but also with substance use disorders, mental health issues, you know, you name it. Like I said, you know, kind of that 365 approach, you know, this 360-degree, rather, approach is, you know, is just instrumental in the success of our program. We've been around for 30 years, and, you know, we continue. We have no plans to stop anytime soon.
Well, and when I said it's like being on steroids, you're right. Two groups a day is amazing, but just living with each of the guys and and shooting the stuff with them and having them. I mean, when Patrick said that a group was super important, he also referenced the fact that I wouldn't have to work so hard because there'd be other people in the group that would help hold each other accountable. And you know, it means something when it's coming from somebody who's working the program too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Uh-huh. Yeah, there's, you know, the old adage and you know, going to group therapies, even when you're not doing work, you're doing work.
Yeah, the work occurs before, during, and after the group, and what they learn in group, they take outside of group. So
absolutely, absolutely. You know, and one of the cool things also about our program is all of our full-time employees, including myself, are alumni of Prescott House. With the exception of our IT guy, you know, so a lot of our guys will stay in town in Prescott rather than go home. And those guys, usually we get a lot of guys, a lot of alumni that will come back to work for us. That provides so many advantages for us as a treatment center in that, you know, our guys know the tricks. We know where the you know, metaphorical hiding spots are, and it's easy to flush our guys out. So if somebody chooses to be fully engaged in the program, they're going to gain so much, whether they're there for, you know, 30 days or a year and a half.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that I really believe is that sex addiction invariably is not seen and treated by itself. There are always other propensities for addictive behavior, like you mentioned earlier, gambling or overeating or overworking or drugs or alcohol. And so I can imagine that being in a house with other addicts and, you know, doing a process group would help a sex addict determine, hey, are there other parts of my life that are out of control? Or could they easily become out of control? Because I got a lot of addicts that when they leave treatment, a treatment center, they stop drinking. Because even if they didn't have a problem, one of the things we know is when sex addiction goes down, another addiction may increase, and vice versa. You know, obviously, if you're going to treat drug or alcohol addiction, sex addiction, if it goes untreated, is likely to increase. So you've got a very comprehensive program at Prescott House, and I really appreciate you sharing all this information and being so partner-sensitive, and I hope that our listening audience will take a look at your website. And again, that website is www.prescotthouse.com, and you can reach them by going to 866-425-4673. Tim, thank you so much for pitch hitting for me and coming on the show this week. And keep me posted about all the stuff that Prescott House is doing, would you?
Absolutely. And thanks for having me. And, Carol, you feel free to reach out to me anytime about any topic. So I appreciate the opportunity, like I said. And, you know, I'm really proud of being a part of Prescott House. And I firmly believe in the work we're doing. And
I get that. You should be. All right, you make it a good week, and thanks again for helping my previous client, too. He is making amazing differences in the world.
You know, I hear that a lot, and every time I hear that, it makes me so glad, makes me so happy, and really, you know, I'm happy he's doing well, and I hope that his family is doing well as well, also.
Well, I'll tell you just one last funny story. Ready? So, you had a booth at ITAP. This was actually 2 years ago. I go every other year. And for our listening audience, ITAP is the CFAT organization that requires that you come and get some continuing education every year or every other year. So I go by your booth, and I grab a Prescott House mug. It's a nice big mug. It holds my coffee, my 2 o'clock coffee, which I'm drinking right now. And I take it to work. I think, yeah, I can do some advertising for you.
Thank you.
Then I thought about the mom who knows that you saved her son's life. And so I take it home. I put it in the dishwasher. I get it all cleaned up. I put it in a bag. And the next time I see her, I say, I've got a gift for you. And she opens up the bag. She starts to cry. She says, I love this. This is going to remind me of my husband. She goes, I'm a coffeeholic. This will remind me of my son's recovery every day. She goes, how come I didn't get one of these? I said, well, you did now. So, again, she sends me, not a selfie, but a picture of her mug in front of the fireplace with the coffee in it. And, I mean, it just meant so much to her. So if I were you, I'd tell your marketing people, they might send these families home with a mug. It just means the world.
Well, not only am I a therapist, I am the marketing. I'm part of the marketing team. So I will noted and know that those mugs are a hot commodity. So I think we need to get some more made.
All right. You take care, and thanks again.
You're welcome, Carol. Take care.
You too. So, again, that was Tim Kernan, and he is at the Prescott House and has done an amazing job with his clients. And I'm just glad you got to hear. What are the advantages of long-term care? Now, I know you may be saying, oh, my gosh, how expensive is it? Well, that's something that you would have to talk with them about and negotiate. And if I'm not mistaken, I'm not allowed to put prices on my show. But I do believe that it's no more expensive for a year than some of our other treatment centers that do 45, 60, and 90-day programs. I hope you're not one of the people that wants this for your husband. In other words, I hope that you don't have a husband that is slipping and relapsing like crazy. But if you do, sometimes it takes extreme measures to make an extreme difference. I'm Carol the Coach, and as I say, every week, there will only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. And we'll catch you next week for more Betrayal Recovery Radio. Make it a good one.